You ask any kid in America, Greg Wyshynski, what does he want? What does she want? They want the beat. They want the hits. The hits, the hits, the hits, the hits. Give me the hits. Give me the hits. All the kids just want the hits, Greg Wyshynski.
Am I doing a show with Wolfman Jack?
Wolfman Jeff. Give the kids what they want, not what they need. I don't know. Give them the hits. Kids want the hits.
Is this in reference to the fact that after weeks and weeks and weeks of clean play, that necessitated an article on Puck Daddy talking about how amazing the NHL is for being suspension-free, that now not only do we have a John Scott suspension for leaving the bench on a legal line change to start a fight, but we also have a hit last night in the Rangers-Wild game that will result in an in-person hearing for John Moore.
Ooh, and that was a bad hit. That was the... That was that the hit that's similar to what started the Rule 48 ball rolling down the hill. I don't think there's any discrepancy on or any sort of gray area when it comes to that hit. It's pretty standard. You know what's going to be called. I know the player commits to the hit and follows through, but geez, that's a tough one not to suspend severely.
Well, you know, if there's a reverse angle on it from the Wild broadcast that makes it look like the possibility that he hit the chest first. But you and I are of the same mind on this one, okay? Which is that it's a predatory hit. And listen, we've been trained by the Department of Player Safety to explore the nuance of every hit. They're like snowflakes after all.
They are.
Right. But I think sometimes we get so caught up in that detail, like we're watching the Warren Report or something and it's back and to the left, that we don't look at the impetus for the hit and the intent on the hit, and I'm sorry, that's a predatory hit. Guy shoots the puck, you're coming across the middle, he's in a prone position, you wallop him, your elbow moves on the hit in sort of an uppercut fashion, you know damn well what you're doing.
Back in the old days, that play never would have happened because you don't make that play in that area as the person carrying the puck. Now you get a free pass or you draw someone into a suspension.
And I think people I guess we're better off,
but I don't really know if I mean it.
But people get 100%. But at least you acknowledge that it's different. I think the problem for a lot of people is that they still think it's 1994, you know, where guys couldn't go to the middle like that. And if they did, they got kabonged and there was no repercussion because Scott Stevens would kill you.
Yeah, no, it's true. Exactly. Is it? It's so subjective. Is it? When you ask, are we better off or is the game better off that it's like this? Did you like it better when there were real significant danger zones in the NHL on the ice? Like you knew you didn't do something? I mean, that's all changing as the game gets softer. I don't know.
Well, no, of course I did. Just like I liked it when we could have fights without anybody worrying about the repercussions to players' brains. It was a great time. It was a fantastic time. Are you kidding me? Who didn't like the 1980s before AIDS? It's all the same thing, Merrick. I mean, there were times when life was a lot less dangerous and we knew a lot less shit about life. But the problem is that we can't have those hits in the middle of the ice anymore. We can't have rampant fighting anymore because we know what it does.
The thing is, we're still getting those hits and we're going to continue to get those hits. All I'm saying is players are still – I don't know whether we're better off – not having danger zones or areas where you know you're not supposed to do something because it's just too dangerous, or are we better off saying, you know what, we're just going to suspend as much as we can to try to get this out of the game, knowing full well it's going to take a bunch of concussions to get there. Like the point that I always make about hitting and making it safer and all that, if I would have said to you back in 2005 when the Department of Player Safety was created and they were going to clean up the game and get certain hits out, and we saw Richards on Booth and so we saw Matt Cook on Mark Savard, and wanted to get all this out and make it safer and opened up the game in the process and made it a faster game. If I said to you, Greg, or anybody listening right now, there will come a time when the NHL will be fast, i.e., you know, 30 miles an hour,
okay,
what the guys skate at, and relatively safe. It's a contact sport, so there's always going to be injuries, but it'll be a relatively safe sport. We're going to make it so that it's fast and safe, but in the process, because you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs, in the process, it will cost 2,000 concussions. Would you have said, I'll take that bargain?
2,000 concussions, and we get that.
Because it's not going to happen overnight. It's like trying to say to someone, listen, man, from now on, you're only allowed to park your car when you're going 55 miles an hour. Eventually, you're going to learn how to do it, but you're going to smash a lot of cars in the process. You know what I mean? Like, I know the intention is good, and trying to get there is good, but it's going to take a lot of concussions. It's going to take a lot of headshots. It's going to take a lot of violence, and it's going to take a lot of brain trauma to get to a place where this game is both fast and safe.
Right.
That's all. That's my little stump speech today.
But we're getting there.
Getting there. It's true. Yeah. All I'm saying is there's another one there. There's another hit that, you know, is probably going to show. I mean, Eric Hall's grandkids are going to have migraines because of that hit.
Maybe. Maybe you got him in the chest, right? It's always the possibility.
Maybe you got him in the chest, I suppose. But you know what I mean? Like, there's still going to be more carnage on the way as this game is. We made it faster. Like, that was no problem. Making it fast is easy. Now we're in the hard part of trying to make it this speed, and let's try to make it a little bit safer out there for the guys.
To go back to your original point, I think it's an interesting one about the fact that there was a time when players didn't go to the middle, and now they go to the middle. Oh. And sometimes they put themselves in harm's way when going to the middle, right?
Remember the old saying, right? Well, he got what he deserved. You don't cut to the middle that hard. How many times did you hear that growing up? And I heard it a ton. Well, he got what he deserved. You don't cut to the middle like that in front of the net when this defenseman is out there. We all know that. Well,
right.
That's changed.
In a roundabout way, you bring up another interesting point about player safety, which is what, and not only player safety, but where hitting is going, which is that what onus do we put on the player being hit? Now, the other hit in that game last night, which I think is apples and oranges from the Moore hit, but people seem to want to group them together as being both real dangerous.
No, they're in the same game, so it's easy.
The Kreider hit on Jonas Brodin. And, like, for me, this is a pretty cut and dry one, okay? Brodin stops about 6 feet away from the boards, either to brace himself for the hit or to begin to play the puck, all right? Kreider doesn't let up, goes right into him, uses his forearm to shove him. Total boarding penalty, total right call, game misconduct, 5-minute major, no problem there. But, I mean, there is a combination of factors on this hit that result in what happened. And Brodin, thank goodness, came back and played, so no supplemental but discipline there. But in boarding, more than anything else, we see situations in which players either take advantage of the rules or know that the rules are in their favor when it comes to playing the puck and protecting the puck and trying to establish space in different parts of the ice. Now, in the rule book, you have the wherewithal to do that, and there is a mechanism for the referee to say, well, he put himself in a vulnerable spot. And that's much more in the realm of turning your numbers to a hit as you're, you know, facing the boards. It doesn't necessarily, I think, address what Brodin did on this play, but I think he contributes to the hit. And maybe that's why the NHL decided not to throw the book at Kreider.
I think he was far enough away from the boards that you can make the point that Kreider was not trying to use the boards as a weapon.
He was definitely trying to inflict damage, though. He didn't hold
that's
up.
Okay.
And he shoved him into the boards with his forearm.
Which happens every game. And that's fine. I don't think we should be in the business of suspending people or penalizing people for having the nerve to be strong. Mm. Strong player. You've seen Kreider? He's like ridiculous. He's a strong guy. I don't think we can penalize him just because, oh, he's stronger than Brodin on that play and flung him into the boards. Mm-hmm. Which does lead to another question, though. And you've heard me bark on about this for a couple of years, and I apologize, Greg, for boring you on it, but do you think this adds another brick in the wall that is, this is inching towards the end of board hitting in the NHL?
Well, it comes back to the basic thing that's the trigger for any dramatic change in the league, which is catastrophic injury. I mean, you referenced it before. Savard, and if we didn't have Booth, and we didn't have Sid being probably the most prominent one, then we wouldn't have Rule 48. We just wouldn't. The hitting to the head would still be within the fabric of the game, were it not for a guy's career ending, Booth being catastrophically injured, and the biggest star in the game facing what we thought at the time was a concussion. We can call it what we want now. It was concussion symptoms for sure. Mm-hmm. And that being the thing that lit the fuse for all this stuff. So the board hitting thing, I don't know. I mean, would it take someone ending up in a wheelchair and then all of a sudden the rules change vis-a-vis board hitting?
Is it going to take a player turning into an accordion on the boards? Like, not just a player. Sorry, I shouldn't have. everyone's a human being, but not just a fourth line player. I'm talking about a superstar.
Yeah, that's the other thing too, isn't it?
Right? It's one thing, it's like, oh, energy guy, you know, it's going to happen, it's unfortunate, but, and that's another thing when it's Ovechkin or when it's Crosby.
And I hate that shit.
I know.
Like the John Moore thing today is a great example. Like there were actually people defending him saying he's not that kind of player. He's now hit two guys.
Did it last year.
In 12 games. He's Trevor Gillies. Like what the hell?
Okay, he's not Trevor Gillies.
Dude, but that's what I'm saying. Like at what point do you become Trevor Gillies? What do you have to do? He's not that kind of player. Why? Because he doesn't fight? I mean, he's hit guys in the head twice in the span of 12 games. Last night was the most petulant little you know what play that we've seen this season, where a guy goes and predatory hits another guy in the head because his team is losing a frustrating game in the Minnesota Wild.
Okay, let me ask you this question then: how much of this is a comment on the Minnesota Wild, where you know, and much like Edmonton's had this rap for a number of years, and they still haven't significantly addressed it? How much of this is, you know, you talk about putting yourself in harm's way. How much has Minnesota put themselves in harm's way by being the team that you can rough up without repercussion?
Yeah, no, that's true.
Like if you want to beat Minnesota, here's one of the ways you do it.
And
physically intimidate them.
They're going to have to deal with that all season long, especially playing in the Western Conference. And that's just going to how it is. It's going to be how it is. They're going to have to deal with it. That you can count on one hand the number of guys on the team that are, you know, Chris Kreider strong. Right?
Yeah. Like they have, well, look, they're not the biggest, strongest, toughest team in the NHL. And you think of a player like Curtis Gabriel, who's probably going to play 1 year in the American League, maybe even if that, and then he'll get the call up, and that's going to raise the size factor for the Minnesota Wild. But they really don't, you're right, they don't really have a Chris Kreider. Like as much as this game is a speed game, man, power forwards are so valuable.
Mm-hmm.
Especially guys that are smart, can hit, can play. Whoa, hey, a hockey player. Jeff's talking about a hockey player. Okay, so I'm describing a hockey player. Okay.
All right. All right. Let's. So you agree with me on the Kreider thing, no suspension there?
No.
All right.
God, no. No.
Okay. Very good.
But more, I think they're gonna throw the book at him.
Yeah,
this could be a big moment for Stefan Quintal here.
Well, that's a very good point.
This could be where he really polishes up his badge.
Shanahan used to get his yayas out in the preseason by suspending guys like 12 games. You know,
he did the
fake practice games and then like five real games. And that's how he would establish his baseline. And now Quintal didn't do that. And now this is the first one he's got on his plate. I'm going to say six, but I mean, that's the minimum for me is six. And rightfully so. I mean, again, dude, twice in 12 games.
Yep.
At what point do you say that this is that kind of player?
I think you have to see a couple of seasons of it.
All right. He's not Rafi Torres yet. He's just the guy who hit two guys in the head twice in the span of 12 games.
I'm just having a hard time adjusting, that's all.
All right, so you say like, you know, six or higher. I say about
sure,
six.
Sure, yeah. I don't know because we're dealing with a new sheriff, so I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Not to bury the lead here. It's a pretty good win for the Rangers last night.
Think? I'm impressed. I mean, they lost some pretty significant pieces in the offseason.
Mm-hmm.
Right. On that back end, but Anton Strahlman is a tough one. Tough one to lose. They lost some pieces back there. But the rejuvenated play of Rick Nash has been a bonus. Marty St. Louis always value. And, you know, the maturation of the aforementioned Chris Kreider has been great for them.
Yeah, he's been great. Zuccarello has contributed. They're getting good performances across the lineup. They've got depth. He can roll four lines if he wants to. It's a good team. And they're a team that has shown pretty early that there's character in that room and character vis-a-vis handling adversity. And I think that's a symptom of, you know, going as far as they did last year. It's been good to watch them so far.
Yep.
The New York
so
Hockey
far, so
Rangers.
So yeah. Far, so fun.
They're the opposite of Tony Romo, so I'm trying to say.
Football, right?
I'm just bitter. You know what happened to me in fantasy football last night?
Oh, geez.
Here's any fantasy player in football or hockey is going to relate to this, okay?
Okay.
So I was leading by about 12 points entering last night's Redskins-Cowboys game. And I was basically boned because the other guy I'm playing has Romo going. Romo's, you know, tagged for about 19 points last night in fantasy. Plus, the Redskins tight end is playing. So right there, it's going to be extra points. So I'm thinking I got no chance. So this dude gets to within about 2 points of me last night. And what happens? Romo gets hurt. And you have that moment as a fan and as a guy playing fantasy hockey. First off, you're playing fantasy, you're playing fantasy sports. So now it's all an abstract. Now you're not even dealing in human beings. You're dealing with names and numbers next to names. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But you have that moment as a fan. Where the fan part of your brain is battling the human part of your brain, and you're like, you know what? The only way I was going to win was if somebody got hurt, and that's somebody's Tony Romo. And as much as I feel bad for this man going out with a bad back, as much as I feel bad for his family, his well-being, as a human being, I don't want to see anyone else suffer, This was the only means to victory. But you know what happens, Jeff Merrick? You learn lessons in life.
What happens, Greg?
I feel as though the hand of Jesus Christ himself came and tapped me on the shoulder and said, dude, what are you doing? Because not only did Romo come back into the game and play, but before he did, I was already losing and lost the week because some no-name tight end of the Washington Redskins caught a bunch of passes in overtime, and I lost already. And I believe that's the sporting god saying, you inhuman, disgusting, deplorable person. You were secretly rooting for someone to get injured, and now here's your comeuppance.
So you could put your head down on your pillow and sleep last night, Greg Wyshynski, knowing you were cheering for injuries yesterday.
One thing we should
point out. Kevin Moriarty tweets in, what about Duclair? Anthony Duclair has been fantastic and a real revelation for the Rangers. And he's breaking breaking the Quebec Ramparts hearts, because he's one of the key guys for a team that's already going into the Memorial Cup next year.
I wrote about him this morning, and Peter P. noted this article that Larry Brooks put out. So they're going to burn a year of his contract regardless, evidently, even if they keep him past the nine games. Or if they don't keep him past the nine games, evidently. There's some mechanism in when he signed his entry-level contract.
Really?
There's an article in the New York Post that talked about this thing, and McKenzie evidently tweeted about it last night, where their whole thing with him isn't whether or not they burn a year of his contract. Their whole thing with him is if they keep him for a certain amount of games, his contract counts towards the 50, and also his UFA status comes 1 year earlier than it normally would. It's a weird situation, but that's the deal with Duclair. Yeah.
All right. I got to look into that. I haven't heard that one before. Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, anyway.
Yeah, so there you go. But he was great last night. And
He's been fantastic. And I see that sort of tongue-in-cheek about the Quebec Ramparts, but really that's a team that he was supposed to not carry, because they have some good players on that team, but he was a big piece of that Ramparts team this year. That's already got the buy into the Memorial Cup final. I was hoping to see him in Quebec City come May, but maybe not. Maybe he stays the whole
maybe
year.
Maybe not. All right, and finally, you know, we talked about the idea of doing just mailbags every day instead of doing QODs, but I think what we hit upon yesterday, thanks to you good listeners, is, you know, if we've got something to talk about in a QOD fashion, we should have the QOD. If not, then we'll do a little mailbag thing, and I think we have an actual QOD today, which is, what is the most deplorable illegal act in hockey? Because the whole point of this question is, I had people this morning telling me, well, what Moore did wasn't as bad as what Kreider did. If you ask 100 players what Kreider did versus what Moore did, they tell you that Kreider's act was more despicable. So what's the most despicable illegal act in hockey? PuckDaddyBlog@yahoo.com, @Wyshynski, @Jeff Merrick on Twitter, #MVSW, or go to our Reddit, MVSW Reddit, and you answer the questions there. What's the most despicable illegal act in hockey? And you answer that question, and we'll read them later on, because coming up in a second, legendary University of Michigan coach Red Berenson will join us. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Oh, Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
When I had my vasectomy a couple of years ago,
touch.
One of the great thrills was I got to sit around and watch Littlest Hobo episodes. It may be the greatest theme song for any television show I've ever heard in my life.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Well, the littlest hobo, he's eating out of cans and playing with his dog. Littlest hobo, he's jumping on trains. He needs such a pie because he's so little.
Debate Hockey.
The show's not actually about a hobo?
No, it's about a dog. It's a hybrid of a German Shepherd and a Husky.
The dog's a... It's about a dog?
Yeah, dude. You've never watched Littlest Hobo?
No!
Merrick versus Wyszynski.
Indeed.
Yeah. When's that Friday showdown coming up?
That's coming up in November.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's coming up in November.
Okay.
Right? That's going to be a lot of fun. Oh, my goodness. Will that be fun?
Yeah.
Yeah, are you going to write the questions for that?
Hell yeah. I'm percolating on a couple of them right now. Yep. Don't worry. I got you. Goodness. I got you for that one. Yep.
Littlest Hobo
trivia. For that one.
Mm-hmm. So exciting. So exciting.
So good. It's going to be so good.
All right. It's time for a legend, sir.
Yes, it is. Indeed. He's the legendary head coach of the Michigan Wolverines, someone we've talked to a number of times on this podcast. He is one of the great storytellers slash head coaches in the game. He is on his way to Grand Rapids, I understand, for the Mike Knuble induction in the Grand Rapids Sports Hall of Fame. He is the one and only Red Berenson. Red, good of you to be aboard today. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you guys? Where are you, by the way?
Well, I'm in Stouffville, a little bit north of Toronto, and Greg's studio is in... Are you in Manhattan, Wish? Where are you in New York?
I am in the city that never sleeps, except if it's, watching the Rangers sometimes. I'm in beautiful New York City. And Red, let's start off with Mike Knuble, one of my single favorite players. Tell us about your love for the immovable object of the National Hockey League, Mike Knuble.
Well, when I first saw Mike, he was playing for the Kalamazoo Junior team, and they were in the North American League, and you could see that he had the body, and he had the hands for a big kid, and his skating was something that would improve over time, but he was just one of those players. He loved to hit, and he loved to shoot. And as I got to know him, I realized what a fine kid this is. He's not just a kind of a rough around the edges player. He's a good student. He's well spoken. He's a gentleman, and so on. So I was quick to recruit him. And he'd been out of high school for 1 year, I believe, that year. And he played in his hometown high school up until then, but he turned out to be a terrific player and a great ambassador for any team he played on, not just Michigan, but when he went on to the NHL. And he was with Detroit for 2 years, and I remember telling Scotty Bowman, you've got to play this guy. You know, he's not getting an opportunity to play with good players because he's going to make a career out of playing well with good players. And he did that when he finally got a shot. I think it was in Boston, playing with top players, and then again in Philadelphia and so on, everywhere he went. But a terrific kid. We had one incident with Mike, and he had a racing heart between periods, and we couldn't get it to stop, and we rushed him to the hospital, and the heart doctor did he did all the tests on him, and he came back to me and he said, you know, I think Mike's going to have to retire from hockey. He's got an enlarged heart.
Wow.
And I said, geez, I don't want to tell you what to do, but would you mind checking, like take two of our other players just randomly and check them? And because I think all hockey players have enlarged hearts, at least that's what I'd heard. And sure enough, he came back and said, you're right, you know, we'll just monitor him, and well, the rest is history. Wow. I mean, Mike's career nearly came to an end, and his dad, unfortunately, died when he was jogging one morning from a heart attack, and as a young man. So, a lot of history with Mike, but what a great kid, and I'm glad they're recognizing him in his hometown.
Did you ever see him play at East Kentwood High? Because he set records there, like shattered records that I think still stand to this day.
Right. I think our assistant coach saw him play there, and you're right. I mean, he was a man amongst boys in high school.
That's interesting stuff. Hey, Red, your Michigan team recently played BU. It was a game in which it seemed like every time the puck went in the net or near the net, there was a video review. It was one of those nights. I wanted to get your take on video review. You said something after the game along the lines of, hey, how did we ever survive without it, in sort of a sarcastic way. Do you like it as a fail-safe, or do you wish that maybe we didn't implement it as much as we do?
Well, you know, I like the idea that we're trying to get it right. I mean, that may not have come across in the interview, but do we have to interview every goal or review every goal? And if we do, we should have the equipment and we should have the sense of urgency to do it now. You know, when a goal is scored, it's one of the most exciting parts of the game. Mm-hmm. And the crowd's into it, the teams are into it, and, you know, one is more excited than the other, obviously, but it's a big part of the game. Well, then you just take everything right out. You take all the excitement out of the building because you take 5 or even 10 minutes to try and get it right. Well, at one point in this game, then the first review, the referee stood in there for at least 5 minutes. So the linesman came over, and I said, "What's the problem?" He said, "Well, they can't, there's no picture on the monitor." Like, are you kidding? Well, what's he looking at then? You know, it was just one of those games where the reviews that, you know, the goal that we scored was called back, but all the other ones were counted. And I never did get the whole story on the review, but nevertheless, I think they take up too much time. Like, you want to get it right, but let's make a good decision on this quickly. And I would also say that don't just put the referee in the box. Like, the way we do it is a lot different than the NHL. The NHL puts it in the hands of Toronto. And those people sit there and they haven't made a call one way or the other. But if I'm the referee on the ice and I make the call and I go out of my way to exaggerate, this is a good goal, and then I go in the box and I have to turn it over, I'd rather the other guy go in there and say, "Oh, geez, we made a mistake and it's no goal." Mm-hmm. So I, you know, we had that happen in the NCAA tournament one year. The one referee stood in there for 10 minutes and I finally got the other referee to go in there with him and help him. And sure enough, within 30 seconds, it was called a good goal. But the one just didn't want to call it a good goal for whatever reason. So it's not always perfect.
Red, if you can indulge me for a couple of seconds, I want to ask you some questions about coaching, about the Soviet Union, and about 1972. You played a couple of games in that 72 series. The crucial game 6, where the referee wanted to fill the box, speaking of penalties, fill the box with Canadians. You set up Cornoyer, beautiful goal, Canada wins 3-2. But correct me if I'm wrong, were you the only player on that 72 team to have faced a Soviet hockey team previous, going back to 59 with the World Championships and the Belleville McFarlanes?
Boy, I think so. There might have been a couple of players like Savard and Cornway might have played against the Soviets, one of the Soviet teams, when they were playing for the Junior Canadians.
Right.
But as far as playing the top team in a situation like this, I may have been the only one. That's a good call. That was in 59, the spring of 59.
Yeah, the Belleville McFarlanes, and you led that tournament. Goals, points, Canada won on goal differential. That 1959 Belleville. I think Mark Crawford's dad played on that team, I want to say.
Floyd Crawford was He was on that team, and they had some former pro players on that team, and they had got their amateur cards back, like Al Dewsbury and one of the Conachers was on that team.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picked up. I was actually playing at Michigan in my first year at Michigan, and Belleville, Billy Ray had been fired as the Maple Leafs coach, and Belleville had hired him to try and to build up the Belleville team. They could add 2 or 3 players, and so I think they got myself, Conacher, and Bobby. He was a good French hockey player from Quebec, but they picked up a few of us to add to the team, to bolster the team. From the previous year, they'd won the Allen Cup.
Right, for senior men's hockey. The question that I have, given your when you played. Experience playing against the Soviet Union, 59 the World Championships, the pair of games, and then obviously the bird's eye view for the rest of the games in 1972. Fred Shiro always talked about learning a lot from Anatoly Tarasov and the Soviet system. And, you know, Anatoly Tarasov would say, you know what, I watch games and I count passes, and I always find the team that makes the most passes ends up winning the game. The Soviet style became all about passing. As a head coach, did any of that soak in for you? Were you in any way influenced from a coaching point of view by the Soviet system you played against a few times?
Well, I don't know if I didn't know at the time I was going to be a coach, obviously, but I would say yes, yeah, some of it. I mean, the skill level that they showed even in 1959 in the World Tournament was something that showed up again in 72. You know, they had exceptional skills, all their players. It wasn't just two or three players. I mean, their defensemen handled the puck just like they were the leading scorer on the team. And they joined the rush, and they shot the puck on their offhand better than we did over here, and so on and so forth. So I remember all that. But you're right, their puck control was as good as it gets. And we had to play our style, which didn't always mesh with their style. But we beat them 3-1 in a real hard-fought hockey game in Prague. Mm-hmm. And the thing about Prague in those days was they were anti-Russia or communism, and so they were all the fans were cheering for Canada.
Yeah.
But when the Russians played Prague, boy, yeah. it was like a war. I mean, you could sense the serious political undertones back then.
Well, and even to this day, Jaromír Jágr wears number 68 the year that the tanks rolled in to then Czechoslovakia. And you're right, those world championships in like 68 and 69, I mean, the Czechoslovakian Soviet games were, I mean, they made the Oilers and the Flames of the 80s look like a walk in the park. One more follow-up on 72, Red, and then we'll move on, I swear. I remember talking to Ron Ellis once, just about style of play, and Ron said, listen, you know, we were a group of, you know, players that, you know, weren't in shape yet for the season. We used to treat training camp as a way to get in shape. You know, we were winded after games. It was a tired team. And Ron made this point. He said, if Russia would have played a Canadian style of dump and chase, they probably would have beaten us because by the end, we would have been too exhausted to do anything. Do you think Ron Ellis was right or wrong?
Well, at the start of the tournament, there's no question that, you know, this, remember, we started in early September, and
yep.
So we had what you'd call a training camp in Toronto, and Harry Sinden was our coach, and John Ferguson was assistant coach, but they brought in over 30 players to play on this Team Canada team, and typically they were the best players from around the league and from their teams and so on, but we had no one to play against except each other. So as much as we worked hard and we trained and everything, we had no game conditioning except just this inner squad scrimmages that we had. And we thought we were ready. And I think the first 5 minutes or the first period in Montreal showed that we were ready. But we weren't ready for a full game, like a real stop and start and high-intensity hockey. And we needed to get into game shape. And it's embarrassing to say that now because teams are in much better game shape in training camp than they were in those days, but that's the way it was. And so all these players had taken the month of August out of their summer to train with Team Canada, but once the game started, and it was, you could tell, I mean, we just didn't have the legs or the endurance.
Yeah.
And they were in mid-season form. I mean, they were flying. But after four games, and we didn't get a lot better as those games went on. I mean, you saw the Winnipeg game was tied,
yep.
And the Vancouver game, we got beat bad. And the poor coaching staff, they're trying to throw new players in to refresh our lineup. But that didn't help because they weren't in any better shape than the guys that were playing. And so finally we went to Sweden the next week, and we continued to practice and play exhibition games against the Swedes. And by the time we got to Russia, we were much closer to being in somewhat better condition. And it started to show. And we led the first game. I think we were up 4-2 in the game going in the third period. And they came back and beat us. But that was the first inkling that I had that we could beat that team. And
quick
no matter
question.
What system we were playing, yeah. Even though we're playing now on the Olympic rink, which is a bigger rink, we had more legs and we had more game instincts and game sharpness than we had when we started that tournament. So
you know,
the Russians had the edge on conditioning, but we got caught up, and then it was a series.
There's a story floating out there. You can confirm or shoot it down, Red, that when you guys got to Sweden, there was a moment which involved I was a park in Sweden somewhere, a case of beer and Phil Esposito sort of having a heart-to-heart with all the players from Team Canada. Is that accurate or not?
Geez, I don't know. I don't remember that. I mean, there's a lot of things about that whole experience that that people bring up even today, and I'll say, geez, I don't remember that, you know, whether I was involved in that or not.
Right.
There were so many things that happened, but I don't remember that.
Yeah.
But I do remember the team got closer. I mean, we got closer socially. We got closer as a team on the ice. The players that weren't playing, you know, that weren't necessarily happy because they're used to being leaders on their teams, accepted their roles, and so we got, you know, we became more of a team than we were when we started the tournament.
And there were guys that left. I mean, the Rangers wanted their guys back. The Punch Imlach wanted the Sabres guys back. Like, guys left.
Yeah, yeah, guys left, and it was too bad, you know. I can't tell you that, you know, if people put themselves in that situation. I mean, these are proud guys, and you know, Vic Hadfield scored 50 goals that year.
Yep.
Playing with Rattel and Gilbert, and they took him off that line for one reason or another, and they put Mihaljevic on the line, and Vic just, you know, he was a proud guy, and he couldn't handle that at the time. But I'll say this for Vic Hadfield. He comes to every reunion we have. The team embraces him. I mean, he's still
great.
Part of the team. So he's been well accepted by the players, even though at the time, you know, he was a defector.
Cool. Greg, thanks for indulging me with my questions with Red from 72. Go ahead, Greg.
I know when to just hand the mic to you and go and get coffee. Hey, Red, two questions about the NCAA. First off, Big Ten Hockey Conference, I think this is year two for you guys. What are the benefits and drawbacks so far from a Michigan perspective playing in this conference?
Well, I think the benefits are that we're playing like schools. You know, like we're a big university, and we're in the Big Ten Conference. All our sports play in the Big Ten Conference, basketball, football, baseball, track and field, you name it. We've got 31 sports, and they all play against the Big Ten, except hockey. And until last year, hockey was playing in what they called the CCHA, and we'd play other schools that weren't in our conference, and for the most part, smaller schools. So now we're playing like schools, and I think it's great. So we play home and home with every school in the Big Ten, and it's been a win-win, I think, for the conference. The disadvantage is that we don't get to see some of the smaller schools that we played before for one reason or another, and they're all in different conferences now, and we may or may not play them. On the other hand, we only play 20 of our 34 games in the Big Ten, so we've been able to play some of the non-conference opponents, like Boston University. We just went out there and played them, and we played Lowell, and we played New Hampshire, and so we're going to go out and play Boston College. So we're getting a chance to play some of the other conference big schools as well. So I think that's a win-win overall for us.
And then finally for me, Red, you and I are both obviously huge fans of NCAA hockey. We want nothing but American college hockey dominance all over North America. Please tell me why Jack Eichel will end up being a better player than Connor McDavid.
Well, I like the fact, like, we just played against Eichel, and I like the fact that his development, I haven't seen the other kid, and you know, he could be the real deal as well, but Eichel is doing it the right way. You know, if he were my son, I'd want him in school. If he were my son, I'd want him in the weight room with people that know what they're doing, and in a serious program with structure. And if he were my son, I'd want him playing against the best players available. And he's playing against kids that are 22, 23 years old. And where if you're playing junior hockey, the oldest player you'll play is a 20-year-old. And so the players in the university are stronger. They're older, stronger. And they don't play as many games. But when they play, they're intense games. If you saw the game that we played BU the other night, I mean, that was a back-and-forth game. And Eichel stood out in that game. And I can tell you, he's going to be a real player.
And lastly for me, Red, and this involves a question about recruiting. And for my entire adult life, you have been one of, if not the finest recruiter in all of NCAA. I do want to ask you, though, and you very famously turned down a $16,000 contract from the Montreal Canadiens because you wanted to finish your education at Michigan. But there are some players who you know they're just going to go to Michigan or to wherever for one, maybe 2 years. You know they're going to leave early. And you've seen this before. It's happened before. The Wolverines happened to all NCAA teams. Have you ever been at the point where you say to yourself, I shouldn't even bother recruiting someone that I know is only going to be here for one, maybe 2 years? Or do you say to yourself, Red, you know what? It's my responsibility to ice the best hockey team. And if we only have them for 1 or 2 years, so be it. I want them on the Wolverines. Where are you at with that?
Well, I'll tell you where I'm at. I think it's great that a kid has a dream to play in the NHL, and I would never want to get in the way of that. But I've always felt that there's life after hockey as well, and everyone doesn't get to live that dream. There's a small percentage of kids that play major junior hockey that are ever going to make a living in the NHL, and it's about the same percentage of kids that are in my locker room at Michigan that are going to make a living in the NHL. But the one thing I can tell you that all our kids are going to graduate. Now, there's going to be a few exceptional players, the first rounders that get signed early that leave early. And some of those kids might not ever come back, but a lot of them do. And we just graduated two kids in the last year that one of them played in the NHL for some time. I won't tell you who it is, but I can tell you Mike Komisarek was in my office yesterday. He flew up here from Florida. And he's re-enrolling in school. And he was a first-round pick with Montreal. And he played 2 years. He was an All-American here, and then Montreal signed him. So he's got 2 years left in school, but he's coming back to go to school. Had Michael not come to school for at least 1 year or two, he would have never been coming back at age 32 wanting to get his degree. And I think that's terrific. So he's going to have a career after hockey. And it's just like Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson comes back every summer. And he's close. He's pretty close to graduating now, and that was important to him and his family.
How is it, speaking of Jack Johnson, that's a pretty famous story where Jim Rutherford wanted to turn him pro with Carolina, and he said, "No, I'm not going to walk out on the Wolverines and Red Berenson." What was that? Take us back to that time with Jack Johnson.
Well, Jack had just finished his first year at Michigan, and remember, he'd been drafted number 3 overall.
Yep.
But I think the story goes further than that. I think it was at the draft when Brian Burke was with Anaheim, and Burke wanted to draft him, number 2, but he didn't want him to go to school. Mm-hmm. And this is what I get from Jack. And so Jack said, "No, I can't wait to go to school. I'm going to school." And he said, "Well, we're not going to draft you then." And Jack said, "Well, that's fine." And so he didn't, and Carolina drafted him. But after the end of Jack's first year, Carolina were in the Stanley Cup playoffs. And they called him and wanted him to join the team, and they thought he could play. And Jack was pretty, he was pretty reasonable. He said, I'm just a freshman at Michigan. Like, I'm not ready to play in the NHL playoffs, Stanley Cup playoffs. Mm-hmm. And they were disappointed in him for that, but Jack was right. It wouldn't have been fair for him. He wasn't ready to step in and displace another NHL defenseman after his first year at Michigan. So, I think Rutherford was disappointed, but I think Jack made the right call. Now, a year later, they traded him to L.A., and L.A. picked him up, and they signed him after his sophomore year. And he was more ready then, and, I don't know if you're ever NHL ready when you're coming out of college after 1 or 2 years, but Jack had a lot of skill, and he was probably too good for college hockey at that time.
Fantastic stuff. Red, this has been a delight. I know you have to get off to the Mike Knuble celebration as he goes in the Grand Rapids Sports Hall of Fame. Thanks for parking a little bit of time for us here on our podcast. It's much appreciated, and best of luck with the Wolverines the rest of the way this year.
Good. Well, thanks, guys, and stay in touch, okay?
Yep, we will. Thanks, Red.
Yep. Okay, bye.
The legendary Red Berenson, Michigan Wolverines head coach. There's some news, eh, Wish? Mike Komisarek going back to school.
I was wondering about that, because we've had some defensemen that have fallen by the wayside this season, Ben Lovejoy being the latest one to be injured. And I was wondering about all of the defensemen who visited the Devils camp in September. Komisarek and Caberle and all those guys. Where are they going? Why aren't they going and getting these jobs? But now we know.
Yeah, Komisarek. Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, good for Mike.
Good for him.
Good for Mike. Why not?
Yeah, we went a little long with Red, but that's completely understandable.
Hey,
when you got
Monica on the... Yeah, oh, you kidding, Red Berenson? Monica McAllister says, "Jeff Merrick, please say Michigan again." Do I say Michigan funny?
All right, you say it. Go ahead.
Michigan.
Michigan.
Yeah.
I think it sounds fine.
Monica, your ears are warped. What's wrong with you?
Dave, I've seen Dave Lozo a few times in the Rangers press box. He evidently has identified that I'm saying my outs and abouts more like you.
Rubbing off on you, bud.
My mind is a sponge when it comes to accents. Like I you know, when I lived in Virginia, I picked up kind of a weird quasi drawl. I got Jersey in me. Ruby gives me a little bit of Midwest now and again, I think, when I talk. It's a very odd cocktail of accents that I deal with. So it's entirely plausible that talking to you, you know, minimum 5 hours a week has rubbed off on me. Probably also listening to incessant blathering of Canadian announcers on every broadcast because we don't have enough American voices.
I was going to say, like, your center ice package for your Game Center Live. You kind of spend a lot of time parked there, Greg.
Oh, well, welcome to beautiful Nashville, Tennessee, where the Predators are out on the ice. Come on, you dicks.
It's not that bad.
You can't find anybody from Tennessee to do the games, speak the regular dialect.
Come on, man. It's Pete Weber. He's a legend. That's
just
respect.
Kidding. I was just using Nashville as an example. I know Pete's the best. Jake writes in, weird hearing Merrick come out in favor of more teams reacting about players getting run, like the post-Lucic hit Sabres. That really worked out well for them, didn't it?
What's that? I missed that. I'm just sending a very very juicy tweet here.
It's talking about the fact that you think the team should knuckle up and respond to teams taking physical liberties with them, and talking about how when the Sabres tried to do that with the Bruins, it didn't work out all that well.
Yeah. Something happens, though, collectively with the ego of the team when you get bullied for so long. And, like, not every team can be the Detroit Red Wings and turn the other cheek and destroy them on the power play. That's what made Detroit a freak for so long. Because everyone points, oh, well, Detroit does it. Well, Detroit's a freak. That's the exception. That's not the rule. Mm. And listen, man, at the end of the day, these are still dudes. And dudes don't like to be intimidated. And dudes don't like to be roughed up in their sport. Mm-hmm. And like to fight back. Not every team is Detroit. And does it always work? No, of course not. You got to do something other than send Paul Gostad out there to get beaten up by Milan Lucic.
That's right.
Jeez.
Sacrificial lamb, Paul Gostad.
Totally sacrificial lamb. By the way, Brandon Spears says, what happened to Remenda's Twitter account? I can't find it. Drew got off Twitter. Drew quit.
Oh.
Called it a day. That was a cozy, 2 months?
Drew Remenda and Tim Peel, two people that got off of Twitter in the last couple months.
Got off, yeah. It's true.
I intentionally didn't talk to you about Peel yesterday, by the way. I didn't want to go down that Peel rabbit hole with you yesterday.
It won't be because you and I differ about 1,000,000%. That is the real versus in MVSW. Whereas I think he's one of the finest officials in the NHL, and you don't.
And I don't.
It's true.
It's okay, though. It's fine. That's why I didn't want to bring it up, because now things are awkward. Now
We don't have to agree on things. It's okay, bud.
It's okay. Do you beer?
Not as much as I did.
Oh,
I'm more of a wine guy.
Now it's all down. Yeah. It's going downhill.
No, but I mean, when have you ever really seen me like sit and drink beer? Like, I can't. I did it in my 20s. I can't just sit and drink a beer after beer after. I just feel bloated.
Because of carbs.
Because of carbs. It's just. I mean, wine. Yeah, no problem. Sure, fill your boots. But
isn't that funny? Like, there has to be some debilitating effect wine has in your body besides the obvious liver connection. Because, like, I feel the same way. Like, there will be weekends when I've had a lot of beer, and then I feel terrible on a Monday, and my pants don't fit the same way. And yet, you know, I'll drink a bottle of wine, you know, 3 nights a week or whatever, and it's just like I feel – I know it can't be good for you, but it comes from grapes.
So it's okay. It doesn't come from barley.
Let's think about that. No, there has to be a carbonation process of beer. That seems unnatural. What is wine? Wine is grapes in a barrel, and then that's it, right? Am I missing a step or two?
I'm sure there's a couple of things. If there's any sommeliers in the audience, I know Matt Cause, a TSN radio, listens to this podcast, and if he's listening to us live, maybe you can tweet us in what the actual difference is. But you know what's interesting about the difference between beer and wine? Frank Zappa always had an interesting point about the difference between beer and wine. He said beer is very much a military drink. Because beer, when you drink beer, something happens to your brain and you want to fight. Where you never see people like go and drink a bottle of wine and want to beat someone up in a parking lot.
Mm, yeah.
What is it about that difference?
that it's a more, it's like a mellower experience than beer. That's a very
think
good
so.
Point. Because you don't, you don't chug wine. Well, you could.
No.
I'm not saying, I'm not judging.
I see. I don't know whether it's a matter of people that are predisposed to violence are predisposed to drinking beer and the opposite true of wine, or it's something actually in the drink itself that either A, chills you out, or B, wants to make you, you know, curb stomp your neighbor.
Right.
I don't know. I just say things like, that's offside and that's a bad pass. That's the extent of my knowledge in life.
Sergei Bobrovsky on IR with a broken finger. That's not good.
Add it up. Just keep on. This is like the knight in Monty Python, for example. Poor Columbus Blue Jackets. Jeez. Oh, man. You want to love them so much. Actually, in a way, it makes the Blue Jackets an even more lovable team because you continue to put roadblock upon roadblock in front of the squad. Oh.
I talked to JD about that last week. I talked about the fact that, you know, adversity visiting this team as early as it has this season can only be a good thing at the end of the day, right?
I guess, but at a certain point, you got to say to yourself, holy smokes, like, adversity is one thing, but, I mean, don't put us what Job went through. Like, we're not trying to help God win a, we're not trying to help God win a bet here, are we?
Did you see the thing that they're doing, by the way, in Columbus? The wall of cannonballs they're doing?
No, what's that?
All right, ready?
Yeah.
They have a wall, right? Every time a player scores a goal on home ice, there's a cannonball that they're going to put on the wall. I think it's just a plastic hollowed out whatever. They put it on the wall. They make it look like it's gone through the wall, like it's been shot out of a cannon.
Yeah.
And so every time a player scores a home goal, they sign the cannonball, autograph it, and then they put it on the wall so the entire wall will look like it's being littered with cannonballs at the end of the season. It's really
and
cool. I've never seen anything like it before.
Does this continue every year, or is there a new wall every year? Because this is going to get pretty big.
I imagine it's they'll do a new wall every year, and then you could probably auction off those cannonballs for charity
Bingo.
For autographs.
Okay. That's good then. Yeah, yeah. If they're doing that, then yeah, home run. Oh, that's a great idea. Do you have that up on PD?
It's on Puck Daddy yesterday, courtesy of Mr. Josh Cooper.
Oh, hey, Josh Cooper. He's been great with you guys, by the way. He's been great. It's cool. I've seen him do like, Josh's been good.
Yeah. He's been very good. Michael Perino writes in on our QOD, the most dangerous hockey, illegal hockey act. I'm pretty sure the most dangerous hockey play is the pregame interview. You may say things about ex-girlfriends, and we know that is so dangerous that you need to be suspended indefinitely and put in electroshock therapy. A little Sean Avery callback
wow,
there.
Wow, yeah, no kidding, eh?
I know, right?
Pretty dangerous. What's yours?
You know, hits from behind rank up there pretty high, but ultimately I would have to say a blindside hit. Is mine.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it sounds like, you know, essentially the argument the NHL makes about fighting. But when a player is not expecting the hit and gets kabonged by another player, I find it to be not only injurious but completely cowardly and despicable. And that's why, you know, I'm kind of got a hard-on for the John Moore hit last night. It's just a hit that doesn't need to happen anymore in this league.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the word predatory is completely applicable to it. The blindside hit remains my most despicable hockey play, I think. What's yours?
Anything sneaky dirty, like butt end. Butt end's a pretty bad one.
Spearing.
But spearing's obvious, and everyone sees it and everyone knows it. Butt end is just sneaky dirty. Slew foot, there's another one. Slew foot is another sort of sneaky, dirty, no one's really going to catch it until the guy goes down. You can't really see it. It's not an obvious play. Cowbell. Cowbell's pretty bad. I don't think anyone's a big fan of the cowbell. And thankfully, it doesn't happen very often in the NHL, but I'd isolate those three.
Cowbell.
Stick to the pills, yeah. In an upward motion. I don't know. I've always just called. I don't know. There must be an official name for it. I've always just called
it
the cowbell.
If you take a stick to the pills in a downward motion, unless you're playing a team of moils, you shouldn't. Stephen Blank writes in, whatever you call Chris Simon to Ryan Hollweg in 2007, full swing of the hockey stick at head felt dangerous to me. Felt dangerous to you? Well, Jesus Christ, yeah.
But Holwig kept. But here's the thing. Holwig kept playing.
Yeah.
Remember that? Like everyone that said suspend the injury. Well, I guess Chris Simon shouldn't be suspended for that then.
Yeah.
Holwig kept playing.
Right, and then in the obvious reversed thing that we always talk about there, then Joe Thornton should have missed a year after the Perron hit.
Right.
We were suspending for the injury.
Precisely.
Lugnut92 writes in, I think it has to be the cross-check shove from behind when a player is bent over a foot or two away from the boards. It seems to have the greatest chance to cause major head neck injury.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's definitely one. Finishing your check high when a guy is against the boards, too, is just a terrible play.
Yeah.
Or bashing your opponent's head against the glass several times, but that doesn't actually result in a suspension.
It's the Shea Weber. The Shea Weber turnbuckle. The see, I've always been of the mind, and again, I was out such a great day yesterday after the podcast. Took TJ out, my 4-year-old, playing hockey. This is the Magnus Center in Newmarket has an open skate on Mondays where dads and moms can go take their kids and play hockey. I'm playing hockey with my kid, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, eventually if he wants to continue with hockey, there's going to be body checking, and it's going to be, you know, maybe some awkward moments, some moments where he hurts himself, and that's just going to happen because it's a contact sport. But I'm very much of the mind that as I teach my sons, and we'll see if Brody wants to get involved in hockey too, as I teach my sons how to play hockey, I'm going to instill in them this idea that they should expect to be hit at every single moment. Like, just expect it. And if it doesn't happen, that's a bonus. But in your mind, wherever you are on the ice at all times, expect to be hit. I still think that's a really sane way to teach kids and for players to play right now, other than the ones that are out there just trying to draw a penalty. Because I honestly still put a lot of onus on the person getting hit, putting themselves in a dangerous position in a dangerous game. Didn't that sound like, am I way off base by that? Like, expect to be hit every single moment and adjust your body accordingly.
I don't think you're off base on that, but I think that's like trying to defend the indefensible. I mean, you're always going to be caught in some way, shape, or form when you don't expect it, right?
I guess in some situations. I just don't know that that's at the front of a lot of hockey players. I'm going to sound like an old man. Especially this generation's hockey player, right?
We had our head on a swivel.
We had to know who was on the ice at all times. Not like these kids today flying around doing fancy tricks. They don't know who's out there. Who's going to do anything
and twerking
to them.
And oh yeah,
texting and twerking on the ice.
Yes, the Miley Cyrus hockey school. Texted and twerking.
Rocker LKJ writes in, kneeing. ACL injuries are gruesome, and there's no way to defend against a guy sticking his knee out if your foot is planted on the ice. It's instinctual to move your head when you see an elbow coming for it, not so much a knee. I'll say that, you know, if you took 10 kneeing penalties or 10 incidents of kneeing, how many of those 10 would be intentional, do you think?
Very few, and plenty of them would be players trying to get out of the way of a body check. So instead of taking the hit, they try to get out of the way of the body check. And what's the last body part to move? Your leg. So what ends up sticking out? It's your knee. And it looks like the player's going for your knee, but if you follow the skates, he's not. And it's the other player trying to jump away from taking the hit as opposed to just taking the hit, which is the way you're taught to do it. But don't get hit. Like, you know, I used to always laugh. Ally Afraidy, you know, the big defenseman, Toronto Maple Leafs, Washington Capitals, Quebec Nordiques, used to always, the word around the NHL was always, oh, don't hit him. He doesn't like getting hit. And I always thought to myself, who does? Well, one player out there likes getting hit. Because the hits will get him angry and it'll wake him up. Well, who does like getting
Lucic.
Hit? Lucic. Guy, yeah. He loves getting hit.
I think Lucic's power bar gets higher and higher every time he takes a hit. He absorbs it. He's like that monster in Green Lantern that absorbs fear and gets stronger. Yeah.
Did you see? By the way, speaking of Lucic, did you see Strombo's interview with him on Hockey Night Saturday?
I didn't.
It was one of the most surreal moments I ever saw. So they do this interview, blah, blah, blah. They're talking about handshakes and sportsmanship. And as fans, we have unreal expectations because we want players to hate each other on the ice. And then when the buzzer goes, we expect them to be best friends, which is a really good point, by the way. And then at the end of it, George tells a story about how he's coming to CBC that day. And he was stopped by this Buddhist priest who gave him a wrist bracelet and said, "Be safe today, be safe today." So at the end of the interview, there's Strombo, big Habs fan, finishing an interview with Milan Lucic, and he tells him the story, and he gives Milan Lucic this Buddhist peace bracelet. It's one of the more surreal things I've ever seen on a hockey broadcast. I thought for sure, I was waiting.
Thanks for the bracelet. If I stretch this thing out enough, I might be able to use it as a noose or something.
Next time I play the Habs, be like Eddie Shore putting nooses on my goaltenders.
For you idiots, I'll email in. Yeah, I know. My Babcock is my Lucic. My George Lucas is my Kermit the Frog. It's nine impressions. Recycled and reapplied.
They're just tributes. They're just tributes to one another, George. Or Greg. They're just tributes.
C is for cookie. In 1975.
See, it's the same. It's the same thing.
Wow.
Just recycled. I know. It's fine.
It's okay. I get what you're going for.
Let's see. Sean Gentile of the Sporting News writes in, taking off your skate and stabbing someone with it, putting a gun in your sock and dropping an anvil on someone are all the most despicable illegal things in hockey.
I think either Nick Fatiu or Jack Carlson, there's no video of it, there's only audio, in that infamous brawl between the Minnesota Fighting Saints and the New England Whalers, one of them had a skate off and was trying to hit the other guy with it. Oh, yeah, in the penalty box.
I don't know. I mean, I think
putting
a gun in your sock is actually not the most deplorable illegal act in hockey. I actually think it's a deterrent. And this viewpoint was sponsored by our newest sponsor, the NRA. You know, the NRA gets a bad rap. Justin Bourne writes in, whatever the hell you call what Jeff Merrick has on video at his house, if you've seen it.
Oh, yeah, that, yes. But you saw the freshest stuff too, Wish, last time you were over. I just got some new stuff that you were.
Sean Leahy responds to Justin Bourne by saying, "I've seen that snuff film too. Still have nightmares 3 years later." Yeah,
wow,
it's
Sean, Jesus.
I know you've got stuff.
Just some hockey violence. That's all. Old school stuff, black and white. Some of it's pretty grainy, but some leagues that may or may not exist anymore with some players that should probably have spent some time in prison for some of their actions on the ice.
Couple more. Fear the Finn says murder. Would agree with that. Nope. Dave Lozo says whatever John Spano did.
Whoa.
Mark Lazarus says the dry scrape. Bobby Robbins, a.k.a. Jeff Israel, writes in, when you have the puck at the point and you yell, "There's a fire!" and you shoot and score when the goalie is running away, that is a very despicable act.
Let me ask, do you consider it bad form when you're like back checking on a player who has the puck and you beaver tail your stick and he passes the puck back to you? Is that considered poor sportsmanship, or is that just, well, hey, dummy, if he thinks it is me and I'm tapping my stick for him?
That's not poor sportsmanship at all, because to apply it to another sport, it's no different than changing your cadence at the line if you're a quarterback to try to draw the defense offside. No, it's not sneaky and deplorable if you're exploiting the other team's stupidity at all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because Alex Rodriguez did that at in a Blue Jay game. Infield fly, and he's rounding the bases, and he tells the third baseman as he's going past him, "I got it," and the third baseman peels off. The ball drops.
That's great. That's perfect, right?
I love it, but some people are like, "Oh, it's bad sportsmanship. You shouldn't do that."
And finally, Ed writes in, "It must be stepping on the logo in the locker room." So true. The most illegal illicit act that you can have in hockey.
Oh, I know. So disrespectful. We love our logo so much, we put it on the floor.
Real quick, before we go, I feel like as a geek, I should probably share this information with you. It all came out during the podcast. Jeff might have been not privy to it because he was so involved in his Red Berenson interview that he didn't know this all happened.
What happened?
May 6th, 2016, Captain America Civil War, Cap 3, Iron Man versus Captain America.
Hold on.
Yeah, go. There's more.
I was going to say, this is what you were doing while I was talking about the Belleville McFarlanes. Like, did you have no respect for the Belleville McFarlanes and the history?
November 4th, 2016, just in time for your when the weather turns cold, Marvel turns up the heat with Doctor Strange. Evidently, although he wasn't introduced today, starring Benedict Cumberbatch, a.k.a. Sherlock. May 7th, 2017, Guardians of the Galaxy 2, set your boners on stun. July 28th, 2017, Thor Ragnarager, right. a.k.a. Thor 3.
November 3rd, 2017. So three movies in 2017. Black Panther, the first African-American-led Marvel superhero not named Blade. May 4th, 2018, Avengers Infinity War Part 1, in which they battle Thanos. July 6th, 2018, Captain Marvel, a.k.a. the first female superhero lead character in the Marvel Universe. Very excited for that.
So, do we need to get you some Visine?
Well, oh, wait,
Hang on, are your eyes all...
We're not even done yet. November 2nd, 2018, The Inhumans, a.k.a. we don't have the rights to the X-Men, but we're going to try to do a mutant movie anyway. And then finally, Jeff Merrick, the end of Marvel Phase 3, May 3rd, 2019. Mark your calendars now. Avengers Infinity War Part 2.
Someone now, get Greg. Someone get Greg some Visine right now. His eyes have dried out because he doesn't have enough loose skin to blink.
I don't have any skin to blink.
Hey, I'll set your boners on stun. That's a good line. Don't worry, this will just stun. hey, right. Maddie sent us some here on our chat. Binghamton Senators forward Brad Mills has been suspended 20 games for violating the terms of the AHL-PHPA, the Professional Hockey Players Association, Performance Enhancing Substance Program.
Yeah, I just saw that too. Brad Mills. Wow. Where do we know Brad Mills from?
Ivy League, Yale.
He's a Yale guy. Senators.
Yeah.
Oh, is he?
He's bounced around the American League for a number of years, most notably with Lowell and Albany playing in the Devils organization. But
I hate to say this, but don't you? Whenever you see this though in hockey, does your mind immediately go to steroids, or does your mind immediately go to what is the thing that he put in his body that he didn't realize was going to violate this test?
Yeah.
That's my first like when it comes to baseball and a guy gets a steroid suspension. My first thought is okay, this guy got caught. He tried to mask it. He tried to do whatever, and you know it didn't work out. Whenever a hockey person gets caught. Or somebody in hockey gets caught. Like, my first thought is, okay, what is the quote-unquote herbal supplement that his boy at the gym said could help him, and then he's so stupid that he took it, and now he got caught for performance-enhancing. Like, what is the thing that happened to this guy?
My feeling on it is always the same when I see someone fail a drug test. How dumb can you be? Drug tests are so easy to beat. Like, they have stuff that clears out of your system in 24 hours. Victor Conti was right. It's not a drug test. It's an IQ test. You just failed an IQ test, which is why I tend to believe what you just said. Took something, bought something over the counter. There was some ingredient that was not listed or that he didn't know about, and oops, I got popped. That's my first thought. Mm. That may be a very cynical way to think, and I get that, but that's where my brain goes instinctively.
Steve Castaneda writes in, the Inhumans are not mutants. I know they're not mutants, but the point is that they don't have the rights to the X-Men, so they're going to try to create their own X-Men-like franchise of super. They don't have the X-Men, and they don't have the Fantastic Four at Marvel Studios. Yeah. So they need to come up with some sort of a team-up movie beyond the Avengers. The Inhumans are the obvious. I know they're not mutants.
On a hockey podcast, this is what you're getting called out for.
Right. I know. We had 25 minutes with one of the greatest coaches in the history of hockey.
Awesome.
And more people are
fantastic.
More concerned about the Inhumans aren't mutants than anything else.
Look, dumb, you're wrong about the Inhumans.
Honestly,
this
is the important
podcast.
Thing.
What?
I could do without Thor 3. I don't need it. Thor 2 was all right, but it was one of the most disposable, instantly forgettable Marvel films. I could do without it. Did you see any of them, Merrick? Did you see the Avengers or Iron Man or any of these movies?
I saw Iron Man. Oh, yeah, I saw Iron Man on my way to China. I loved it so much that I watched it. Like, the movie ended on the flight, and I watched it again right afterwards. And I saw two,
right,
and that wasn't that great.
Like.
I loved Iron Man.
Your boys
are
going to be all
man,
about
I loved
by
Iron
the
Man.
Avengers 2 comes out in 2019, your boys are going to be all about this shit.
I know. I gotta get caught up. Well, right now they're into Spider-Man, but the old like 1970s Spider-Man that I watched. You watch all those on YouTube.
Well, like the cartoon.
Yeah.
They love it. Wow.
Yeah, the cartoon.
That's funny because my daughter's in. She watches Spider-Man. I don't know if she gets it, but she also watches a show called Teen Titans, which is a very sort of like kids-oriented show that involves Robin and the Cyborg and whatever. And she loves that show. And I think that's like that's now the entry point for a 4-year-old into the superhero world.
Yeah, we had to calm it down for a few months when TJ really started hitting and said, "Well, Spider-Man's allowed to hit." It's like, all right,
you see,
it's time to calm down Spider-Man a little bit. So that's when I made sure that he discovered one of my favorites, Secret Squirrel. So started watching Secret Squirrel after that.
I kind of had to deal with that this weekend too, because I've been showing Vivian I've been showing her the 1960s Batman. She loves it. Oh, God.
Biff,
she loves
pow, bam.
Yeah. So she starts doing that, and like I'm looking at her, I'm like, oh, God. And I had to stop and say, you know, you can only hit daddy, right?
Hey, Adam West, great interview with him on the latest Gilbert Gottfried podcast. Really good, really good stuff on Batman.
Oh, really?
And what might be the line of the year is Gilbert's podcast with Alan Thicke, where he asked Alan to describe himself as an actor. I think that was the question. And Alan Thicke said, I'm the affordable Shatner. When you can't get William Shatner, call me. I'm the affordable Shatner.
He was a great,
that was great
TV dad, and he was great on
Thick of the Night.
Where the hell was his talk show?
Oh God, yeah. It was awful. It was terrible. It was cringe. Oh,
but it was a show that you laughed at though.
I don't know that I ever did for Thick of the Night. Couldn't do it. But it's a hilarious interview.
Yes. I still haven't checked out the Gilbert podcast. I'll do that. All right, listen.
Go listen to the first one you should do is listen to the Penn Jillette interview with Gilbert Gottfried. That's the best one.
I'm trying to think what I listened to podcast wise over the weekend that I was really impressed with. Nick Frost was on what's his face?
Mark Maron?
WTF. Oh, yeah, okay. It was in the Marin podcast. Nick Frost is the guy who does the movies with Simon Pegg, Shaun of the Dead, and Hot Fuzz, and those films. He's brilliantly fantastic and funny. And his road to stardom is really, really funny, where he like was working in a Mexican restaurant in London when he started doing some stand up. Did a series with the BBC. A series got did 2 years. Then he was done, and he was back working in a Mexican restaurant. It's great stuff. Very good interview.
Patrick.
Right, we've got off on too many tangents.
No, hang on. Patrick M. sums it up great. I guess if Jeff Merrick gets to go all baby bear on Red's hockey history, Wyshynski gets to go all baby bear on Marvel movies.
It really did even out today, didn't it?
It did. I know. You got your geek out. I got mine. It's all good. We're all even. It's fine.
Right, exactly. But and now hopefully somebody comes through with a mop now that we're both done.
I know. Call them up and bucket, man.
Boys and girls.
Time to get out of the theater.
Yeah.
Clean up over here. We got a
Thanks
spill
to
over
Berenson
here.
Thanks for class. For classing up the joint, we will be back tomorrow undoubtedly to talk about whatever the John Moore suspension is and then some other things as well.
12 games tonight, too.
Yeah,
jeez.
I'm Greg.
Woo.
I'm Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I'm Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet. Watching games tonight? Well, really.
Have you been negotiating with another network?
No, I'm just not sure of. You know, I'm fascinated, as Alan Watts once said, with the question of, who am I? These are sounds that I make to identify myself, but who am I, really?
You're a celebrity. Oh my God, you know what we didn't do?
What's up? Oh, the Calgary story. Okay, you guys have waited long. Okay, you guys stuck with this freaking podcast for an hour and 15 minutes. So we'll go quick. So we're talking. Yeah, I'll go quick. I'll do it over some convenience shopping music. Okay, we were talking about 1983 yesterday and Wayne Gretzky and that amazing game he had against the Winnipeg Jets, and I got back to thinking about the Calgary Flames. They came over from Atlanta in 1980 to play at the Corral Center for 2 years. There's the backstory on this. So they open up the Saddle Dome, which is a fantastic arena, and they really wanted to accommodate as many handicapped people as possible. So they had a really awesome section. Like, a lot of rinks, like Maple Leaf Gardens would have, like, you know, you could fit like one wheelchair in each corner. So it'd be like four spots. If you're handicapped, you could actually go and watch a hockey game. But the Saddle Dome, people that constructed it, created a really great section for people that need the assistance of a wheelchair. So what do you think hockey fans did, Greg Wyshynski? 3, 2, 1. The main problem they had was with people renting wheelchairs, going to the rink, buying tickets in the wheelchair section so they could get good seats.
That is so brilliant and actually completely syncs up with things that I have not done myself but know that others have done, which is the 100%. Same sort of thing to skip the line at Six Flags.
Right? It's so, Guy Caballero. It's Guy Caballero from SCTV stuff. Now, one of the issues was, I haven't given the complete story, one of the problems was when they opened the Saddle Dome, they oversold their season tickets. Like, Cliff Fletcher had to come back from vacation to calm everyone down and get it all sorted out. So a lot of people that were like, well, I got hooped on my season tickets, so I'm going to take a handicap spot at the Saddle Dome.
But doesn't this circle back...
hockey.
That's brilliant. But doesn't this circle back to what we talked about earlier in the show about me rooting for injury in a fantasy football game? Like, I am a big believer of karma. What goes around comes around, all of that jive. I really think you're tempting the fates if you pull that scam, don't you?
Oh, God, yeah.
Right?
When you park, like, no matter how quickly you're going to go into the 7-Eleven, do you ever park in the handicap spot?
No, because you do that, and the minute you stand up to go walk wherever, when your scam is done, a Mack truck is hitting you.
That's right. It's true.
All right. Well, thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to everybody who works out, getting that extra 17 to 20 minutes in today. We sort of short-changed you yesterday, so now you
sorry
can get
that.
Your reps in. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry about that.
And we'll talk to you post-haste. Bye, everybody.
Yeah. Tomorrow. ¶¶